is ridiculous, he said. All of you, come into the hall. We'll manage for tonight. But I'll see to it that we get more tables and benches for the future. From now on, this household eats together.
The servants won't like that, Locage murmured in Ali's ear. She looked at the old hostler.
They'll learn to live with it, I suppose, she replied. Somebody told me that's how it used to be done in older castles. The household ate and slept all together. It's only been the last 2 centuries that nobles took quarters of their own and the servants had a separate hall to sleep in. Locage gripped the back of Ali's neck with a friendly hand.
A word of advice. Slaves aren't so knowledgeable about history, he murmured. Not Rakka slaves, not Loaren slaves, unless you've been specially educated and sold as a tutor. Are you a tutor?
Ali smiled at him.
That's so sweet, she replied. My Da always said my brains were too big for my head.
Locage looked into her face, his roomy dark eyes inspecting her almost pore by pore.
If I were you, little parrot, I'd rub dirt in my bright feathers and work harder to pass for a sparrow, he said.
Ali spread her tunic, streaked with grass and mud stains.
The goats have taken care of that, don't you think? I'm sparrowing already. Chirp, tweet.
She winked at him and entered the castle. She wanted to change to her spare set of dry clothes before supper and to return Sarai's hairpins. That night, when she dreamed her crow lessons, Nawat was not there. Instead, the senior female crow took over. In addition to teaching Ali new sounds and hearing Ali's explanation of sounds and behaviors made by humans, she introduced Ali to the new crows who had come to Tenere. Ali saw no sign of her friend the next day either. She heard and easily interpreted the calls of the crows, but Nawat had become company for her, out alone with the goats. She missed him as she took shelter under a tree from the day-long drizzle. With Nawat to talk to, she wouldn't have been so aware of the cold and damp. To warm up, she tried some of the hand-to-hand combat exercises she had learned, but soon found that mud and wet grass made for tricky footing. More often than not, she went sprawling, which amused both the goats and the crows. When she returned to the castle at the end of the day, she found that long tables and benches had been placed in the main hall. There was an order to the seating. The Duke and his family were on the dais, near the big hearth. The servants were arrayed at a long table set at right angles to the left of the dais. The men-at-arms who were not on duty took their seats at the first long table to the right. The slaves had lower tables, those with special skills like carpentry and smithcraft on the right, with the soldiers, general slaves like Ali, and the slave maids on the table below the free servants. The new arrangement did not sit well with everyone, particularly the free Luwaren servants and the men-at-arms who had come with the family from Rajmuat. Ulasim and the 15 other full and part-blood Rakka seemed perfectly comfortable. Ali was just happy to be warm, dry, and sitting down. Once the weather cleared up the next day, Dov and Sarai began regular visits with Ali after they and their guards took a morning ramble through the country around their new home. Sometimes they brought Petran and taught the 4-year-old to ride her pony as her guard guided it on a lead rein. Ali welcomed their company, particularly since Nawat had not returned, neither in her dreams nor during the day. She soon saw that, on the older girl's part, her attraction lay in her stories of Tortal, those too bloody or full of bedroom gossip for Petran and Elzrin. In exchange, Ali extracted Isle's gossip from her visitors. Sarai knew most of the Luwaren and Rakka nobility, as she had been presented at court. Her descriptions of life there were precise, cutting, and without illusions. Dove seemed to have spent her time in Rajmuat in different circles, among the capital's intellectuals and more worldly merchants, studying politics, trade, and the affairs of foreign nations. The more time she spent with those girls, the more respect Ali had for them. They would have been at home in the circle of clever, observant women that were Ali's adoptive aunts. More than once, Ali caught Dove eyeing her after she'd asked a question that a slave might not be expected to ask. She had to wonder if Dove, at least, did not suspect there was much more to Ali than a metal ring around her neck. Sometimes the Balitang stayed long enough to eat lunch with Ali. More often they visited for a short time before they returned to the castle and the duties Winamin had set for them. With only a fifth of the servants who'd worked at the Rajmuat house, every member of the family was now required to help with chores. Mequen met with villagers, supervised repairs to the walls, and oversaw the building of new sheds and sleeping quarters within the castle walls. Sarai and Winamine plied their needles, not on ladylike embroidery and tapestry work, but on plain sewing for the household. Dove, who loathed needlework, worked in the stillroom and learned to spin. When the older girls described their labors to Ali, they spoke as if work were an adventure. Ali hoped they would feel the same when winter made it impossible to leave the castle. Twice, a merchant caravan came to Tenere with supplies. On both visits, Ali saw the merchants reach the Balitang lands through the road in the rocks. The crows warned her ahead of time so that she could look over the merchants and decide if they were a threat or not. They were always welcomed at village and castle, both for the items they carried and for the news of the realm. 2 weeks after her arrival at Tenere, Ali was drowsing in the late morning sun when the crows set up a racket that made her jump to her feet and draw the stolen knife from her waistband. She couldn't tell what they were saying. None of their sounds were those she had been taught. Skeins of shrieking birds flew by, bound for the southern road, where they circled and dove at a man who walked there. Ali sharpened her sight until she saw the newcomer as clearly as if he stood before her. A young man of her age, he carried a sack over one shoulder, one not big enough to hold what he might need for life on the road. His Luaran-style tunic and leggings were patched and darned, showing plenty of wear. He was barefoot, and he walked in an awkward manner, as if he had not really mastered the use of feet. The strangest thing about him was the way his skin looked to her sight. Feather patterns showed under every inch of bare flesh. Curious, Ali told the goat, "Stay," and trotted down to the road. Something about that feathered pattern was very interesting. "Hello, Ali," the newcomer said in a pleasant baritone as she approached. His skin was dark, but not Raka brown, more like her dad's coloring than a Raka's. His eyes were brown, long-lashed, and deeply set on either side of a long, thin razor of a nose. His cheekbones were sharp, his chin square with a hint of a point. His mouth was long and slender, the lower lip fuller than the upper. He wore his short black hair tousled, as if he'd combed it back with his fingers. He was nearly 6 feet tall with a wiry build. The way he moved, Ali half expected him to leap straight up into the air at any moment and not come down. The feather patterns under his skin were even clearer to her sight up close than they'd been when she first looked at him. She thought that if she touched him, she might feel feathers, as if he'd pulled a human skin on for a disguise. He'd called her by name. "Do we know each other?" she asked. "I looked different before." The newcomer knelt and placed his sack in the roadway. "I am sorry I have been away so long," he added, undoing the knot and spreading out the cloth. "I had to practice this shape. It is not what I am used to. I am used to it now, though." He looked up at Ali. "I am here to serve you and the two-legger queen-to-be." Ali peered into his face. If he wore another shape normally, one with feathers. "Nawat?" she whispered. Nawat smiled at her, his entire face lighting up. "I did not want you to see me fumble like a nestling," he explained. "The shape and the talking are hard. My friends say I'm even sillier than a nestling." He waved up to the crows whirling over their heads. "But are you a mage?" Ali asked, tucking her knife back into her waistband. A shapeshifter? A god? But I would have seen those things in him," she thought, completely bewildered. "I am Nawat Crow," Nawat replied. "They could do this if they wished." He looked up at the crows again. "They do not wish." Ali sat on a boulder at the side of the road. Aunt Dane never said crows could make themselves into humans. Nawat shrugged as birds did, thrusting his shoulder blades up from his back. "We do not give away all our secrets." He smiled. "I can help you better this way. I learned to make arrows for the two-leggers." He gestured to the contents of his open satchel. "They prize arrows, and no one makes them by the stone sticks where you live." "Castle," Ali murmured, nibbling her lower lip as she tried to work this all out in her mind. She nearly had control of her thoughts when she made the mistake of truly looking at Nawat's satchel. "Gotta save me," she whispered in awe, picking up a feather as long as her forearm, stippled in a pattern of gold and soft black. "This is a griffin feather! And this one, and this..."
How did you get these? She asked. They're worth a fortune. Everyone knows you hit what you shoot at with griffin fletching.
They are sparkly, Nawat said. The griffins shed them. I thought if I brought you a present that was made of discarded things, no one would punish you for having them.
Steel glinted through the heap of shimmering griffin feathers. Carefully, Ali pushed them aside. At the bottom of the pile, she found strips of metal shaped like bird feathers. She gulped. With a trembling hand, she lifted a feather a hand span in length and drew its tip along the corner of the cloth satchel. The corner fell neatly away as if sliced by a razor.
Stormwing feathers? She whispered, meeting Nawat's deep-set gaze. You're carrying stormwing feathers?
Again that shrug.
They molt, Nawat replied. The feathers are shiny. I collected them and washed them, he added.
Ali was glad to be sitting down. Neither griffins nor stormwings liked others to approach their nests or flocking grounds. Her own mother would rather face a company of hill bandits than a nesting griffin.
What did you mean, the two-legger queen-to-be?
She lives with you in the the castle, Nawat corrected himself. She flocks with you sometimes, when you sit with them, he pointed over Ali's shoulder. When she looked back, she saw that the goats had followed her and were grazing beside the road.
So much for telling you to stay, Ali remarked, more to herself than to the goats.
She turned to watch Nawat again.
He means sarai or dove, I bet, she thought.
That's why Kiprioth wagered me that I couldn't keep the children alive. He wants a half-Ra-Ka queen, and he fears he won't have a contender after this summer.
Are you not glad that I came? Nawat
asked, a worried look on his handsome face.
I will help you better this way. With arrows, with the crows, I will be your friend.
The word hit Ali's own heart with all the force of an arrow loosed from a bow. She had no real friends here. Spies don't have friends at all, she told herself. But Nawat's offer was impossible to resist. She was lonely. Nawat at least wouldn't penalize her for being Luaran, Tortalan, a slave, or her parents' daughter.
Put those away, she told him, pointing to the piles of feathers. We'll go eat lunch and figure out what story you will tell the Balitang so they'll take you on as a fletcher.
I cannot say I am a crow? Asked Nawat, tying his satchel up once more.
You can, but they'll think you're mad, Ali said. They won't let you near the family unless you have a story they will believe.
You will tell a fine story, Nawat said cheerfully. You do well with such things. Ali grinned.
Thank you for the compliment, she replied.
It is my first, replied Nawat. I am glad my first compliment is a good one. Ali looked at him to find his eyes twinkling with mischief. Ali shook her head with a smile. It would be good to have a friend who was a crow. They knew how to have fun. She worried about taking a stranger who was not Ra-Ka home, but her worry turned out to be useless. The castle's part Ra-Ka bowyer, Faltin, was a single man whose son had drowned at sea 2 years before. Nawat reminded him of his lost child. Faltin took the young man into his village home eagerly, particularly when he had seen the treasure trove of feathers Nawat brought with him. Hearing about the newcomer, Duke Mequen, Sergeant Veron, and Ulasim each went separately to Faltin's shop or to his home to meet Nawat. All returned with good things to say. Nawat's singularly innocent, friendly nature opened doors for him that the feathers did not. Ali overheard Ulasim tell Lokage,
"The boy is a bit simple, but good-hearted.
No threat to us as far as I can tell."
At some point during the summer, she would find out what precisely Ulasim meant by us, but for now she was glad that no one seemed to think Nawat was dangerous. She did wonder if Kiprioth had done anything to smooth the young crow's way, but if he had, Ali saw no traces of it anywhere. Nawat also drew a good deal of attention from the castle and village girls. Whenever Ali returned for the day with her goats, she would find one or two girls lingering around the bench where Nawat worked, outside Faltin's workshop where the fumes from the glue he used would disperse in the open air. Often one of those women was Sarai, who told Dove in Ali's hearing that she thought Nawat adorable. For some reason that soured Ali's mood, until she realized that Nawat treated Sarai with the same friendly grace he showed to every other person in Tanair. He kept his most wicked glances and murmured jokes for Ali.
She wasn't sure if this was a good thing or not, but she was pleased to get something from him that Sarai could not. The hardest thing to remember is to keep your mouth closed. You'll be tempted to say what you know, or mention that you've met folk you've no right to meet. Keep your counsel, hold your tongue. Good listeners live longer. And keep in mind it's harder to keep your mouth buttoned on the things you know more about than those you're with. From a handbook for the Royal Intelligence Service by George Cooper, given to Ali for her 10th birthday. Chapter 7. Conversations. 3 weeks after the family's arrival at Tener, Ali took her goats up into the rocky ground just east of the castle, nearly 3 miles north of the road that led to Kalara Pass. Chen Aul's 9-year-old great-niece, Vishda, who tended one of Tener village's herds of sheep, also led her flock to graze near Ali's. She led her dogs, who clearly thought they could herd so much better than these two-leggers. When Sarai and Dove came with their bodyguards at mid-morning, the four girls started a game of skip-rope on the bare ground next to a watering hole. Sarai was taking her turn, with Ali and Vishda, to spin the rope, when the crows who watched the road set up a racket. Ali dropped the rope and clambered onto a rock to hear them better. Once she could translate what they said, she slid back to the ground where the other three girls waited, staring at her. "Lady Sarai, might I ask a favor?" she asked in her best, well-trained slave manner. Adding a trace of the attitude of one who is versed in secrets, she went on, "I may not say as yet how I know this, but a party is riding this way from the pass. It is led by a warrior in armor and numbers 20 soldiers and 5 others, attendants, I believe. You are a swift rider. Will you carry word of this to His Grace, your father?" Sarai raised her thin brows. "We have men on guard with the road on Tuz-Tanea, Ali," she pointed out. 3 miles south of us, my lady," Ali replied. "The crows do not believe these men are hostile, but a little more warning is always useful."
"You speak to the crows?" Sarai remarked in disbelief.
Ali smiled and bowed, now the mysterious mage.
"Say rather, my lady, they speak to me."
It's the truth, too, she thought, waiting for the young noblewoman to make up her mind. "For once it would have been useful if I were mother," she added ruefully. "When she tells people to do things, they snap to. Of course, she isn't a slave in a hostile country."
"Has this got anything to do with Papa and the Duchess's talking to you every night behind closed doors?" asked Dove.
Ali glanced at the younger girl, all thoughts of her mother gone.
"Oh, my lady, you give me far too much credit," she said, meeting Dove's stern gaze with amusement. "As if the likes of them would have serious talk with the likes of me."
Behind her humorous mask, she mentally kicked herself. She had to remember that Dove was quick and perceptive. Sarai beckoned to Fezgau, who waited at a slight distance with Dove's bodyguard and the horses. The Ra-Ka led Sarai's mount forward with his own. She swung herself into the saddle.
"You'd better keep up," she told Fezgau.
With that, she kneed her mare into a trot, then a gallop. Fezgau urged his mount after Sarai, who rode as if she were a centaur and one creature with her horse.
"She's the best horsewoman I know,"
Dove remarked as her guard brought her mount.
"If Mother could ride like Sarai, she'd be alive now. Sarai never would have tried that jump, not without knowing what lay on the other side."
She mounted and followed her sister to the castle, her guard at her side. Ali turned to Vishda.
"Watch my goats for me?" she asked.
The girl nodded.
"The dogs won't mind,"
she told Ali with a grin. Ali raced up into the rocks, bound for the ones that afforded a clear view of the distant road. As she climbed, she realized that she needed to cut herself free of the goats. She had covered all of the ground reachable with a herd in tow. Today she'd been lucky to have Vishda there when the alarm sounded. Otherwise, she might have been forced to leave the goats, risking the loss of some, if not all. They couldn't afford to lose a single animal, and she needed more freedom of movement. Panting, she approached the highest point of a giant slab of granite. Once there, she lay down until only her head rose above the stone, noting the crows scattered among the rocks and trees between her position and the road. Now that she was visible to them, they fell silent. Here came the new arrivals. Clothed Luaran style in tunics and breeches, their armor and weapons glinting in the sun. Their pack animals were heavily laden, as if for a long march or a long stay.
At the head of their double column rode a helmeted man in light armor. Ali sharpened her sight to get a better look, as the Balitang men-at-arms who were posted to watch the road motioned for him to stop. She instantly recognized the leader. Silently, she wriggled back from her vantage point until she could turn over and stare at the sky. Prince Bronow. Why was he here? Had he come as the Duke's friend or as a servant of the Crown? If so, what were the Crown's orders? She hummed to herself, thinking. If Bronow had been ordered to capture or kill the Duke and his family, he hadn't brought enough men. He knew how many trained soldiers the Duke had because he had seen them off on their journey north. For all he knew, the Duke might have added new fighters on the way. Ali smiled. Actually, the Duke had done just that, binding the 6 bandits to him with blood. Their families had trickled up to Tener, solidifying the former bandits' allegiance to the Duke, who now fed and housed them. Carefully, she rolled onto her stomach and crept back to her vantage point, bringing her magical sight to bear on the prince once more. Bronow looked to be in a good mood, joking with the roadside guards as they waved him on. The guard's messenger was already leading his horse out of the shelter of the rocks. As soon as he reached flat ground, he rode off at a gallop, carrying the word of the new arrivals to the Duke and Duchess, not knowing that Sarai would be there before him. Ali continued to inspect Bronow's party. The servants who rode behind the prince also looked relaxed and comfortable. If Bronow's errand was a violent one, surely his attendants and soldiers would be more wary. These soldiers looked as if the only thing on their minds was shedding their armor on this hot, sunny day. Ali slid down the granite slab. She wouldn't know anything more until tonight, when she could collect the gossip at Tener. The Duchess, however, had other plans. Ali and Vijda were about to eat lunch when one of Lokage's boy hostlers rode up on Winamin's own gelding. "Her Grace asked for you to attend her, Ali," the lad told her, dismounting. "I'm to take the goats, and you're to report to Her Grace in the keep. Hello, Vijda." When Ali blinked at him, caught off balance, the boy rolled his eyes and thrust the reins at her. "I know you're practically fresh caught, but even you ought to know better than to keep the mistress waiting." "Oh, yes, of course," Ali stammered. She mounted the gelding clumsily, so that the two watching her wouldn't mention how curiously at home Ali was on horseback, and set out with much flailing and rein-tugging back toward the road. Only when she knew Vijda and the boy couldn't see her anymore did she kick the horse into a gallop. She slowed when she came within view of Tener's walls, but kept the gelding at a trot up to the castle, allowing herself to bounce on his back like the greenest of riders. Lokage himself took the reins from her as she tumbled from the saddle. "You need practice," he told Ali, grinning. "Not on your life," she gasped, as if she had never had to ride before. She lurched into the keep. Dove waited for her at the door. "She wants you," she told Ali and towed her into a small room off the main hall. Normally it was a study, but Winamin stood there now with a basin of steaming water, a towel, soap, and a clean tunic and leggings. "Thank you, Dervisary," she said. "Close the door behind you." Dove obeyed. Winamin turned to Ali. "Wash up, please," she ordered. "I have just promoted you to maid-servant. You'll serve the wine right now, while my lord entertains Prince Bronow, and at table tonight. Ordinarily I would do it myself, but we have no housekeeper now, which means I must make all of their sleeping arrangements." "Could not Ulasim?" Ali inquired. The Duchess shook her head. "Ulasim is off with the men cutting wood for our fires. How could he know we were to have company? Which means I must take charge of our servants and make room for Bronow and his train. Besides, if you are to be our advisor, now is good time to start. I would like to know what you make of Bronow's presence. You may see things with your fresh gaze that His Grace and I would not, having been friends with the prince all our adult lives." "The Duke does not expect me to wait on them?" Ali wanted to know. "No," Winamin replied calmly, "but I can't arrange this any other way. He may be polite and ask you to stand where you can't hear them, but at least you'll be able to form an impression of the prince. Is he hiding anything? Is he uncomfortable? Is he frightened?" Winamin sighed. "I wish he'd given us warning." "I am honored to serve, Your Grace," Ali told her mistress smoothly. "It won't matter if His Grace asks me to stand out of earshot. I read lips." Winamin put her hands on her hips and looked down the 3 inches between her eyes and Ali's. "Well,
Now there's a bit of luck.
Or maybe not luck, with a guard involved.
You read lips. Amazing.
Ali grinned. I thought you might feel that way about it, Your Grace, she replied.
I am grateful for any advantage, the Duchess confided. What a mess. Let's have that tunic off, Ali.
As she helped Ali to pull the dirty tunic over her head, Winamine continued to speak, thinking aloud.
We'll give the second floor to him and his servants. My lord and I will share with Sarai and Dove. His men will have to sleep in the new guest quarters. We haven't got enough beds, but I won't quarter them on the villagers. Our people work hard enough to feed and house themselves. I wish Bronow had known what a burden he was placing on us. Chances are he didn't know how small this place is. At least you don't need a comb.
Ali soaked her hands and arms.
Why me, Your Grace? She asked. Why not a regular maid? You asked for me before I told you I read lips.
The Duchess rubbed cream onto her hands. They were trembling.
We've tried to put a good face on it for the servants and the children. But, Ali, we are in mortal peril.
2 years ago, her voice shook. Ali looked around the room and spied a pitcher and cups on a tray. The pitcher held water. She poured some into a cup and offered it to Winamine. The older woman took it with both hands and drank. When she had composed herself, she said evenly,
His Majesty dreamed that his son Hanneran turned into a rat and bit him. Hanneran and all his household were nailed to cross-trees along Rajmuat Harbor.
Her mouth twisted bitterly.
Needless to say, shipping fell off badly that year.
Ali started to say she knew the story, but held her tongue. It was not something a country maid would have heard.
Now my lord and I are out of royal favor, Winamine said, returning her cup to Ali. The king might still dream about us. And here is Bronow. His could be the breath of wind that knocks us into Rajmuat Harbor.
Ali removed her leggings and pulled the clean clothes on, watching the Duchess through her eyelashes.
Is this your only reason for calling on me, Your Grace?
Winamine twisted a handkerchief in her fingers.
Bronow is amusing, charming and careless. He goes after what he wants. When he doesn't want it anymore, he drops it. We live on the edge of the king's suspicions, Ali, and Bronow doesn't think. The guard says we must trust your insights. I mean to place you where you will get them.
She got to her feet and left as Ali straightened her clothes. Watching the Duchess go, Ali glimpsed a flicker of orange the shade of Dove's gown as the door opened. She wondered how long Dove had been listening. If Dove was going to make a habit of it, she ought to learn that anyone who looked at the opening between door hinges would see a color that didn't match that of the door. The Duchess returned with the wine tray, two pitchers, and cups. Don't kneel, just bow. Serve the prince first, she told Ali. The pitcher with the mermaid on the grip is for Mequin. The wine in it is well watered. Fill Bronow's cup as often as you can, of course. Wine always loosens his tongue. Another thing that makes him a perilous friend.
Ali nodded. Balancing it carefully, she carried the heavy tray up the stairs to the family's private chambers.
A footman led her into the Duke's sitting room, now given over to the prince. Mequin and Bronow sat in chairs on either side of a table, perfectly relaxed. Ali bowed and set the tray down, ignoring the Duke's questioning eyes. She poured out a cup of wine from the unmarked pitcher for the prince and one from the mermaid pitcher for the Duke. Mequin accepted the cup with a slight frown.
"Will Her Grace not be joining us?" he asked, obviously puzzled.
"She's finding quarters for His Highness's servants and guards," Ali said, with a polite bow. "She sends her regrets." Mequin's frown deepened.
"Then why does she not ask the house—"
He stopped abruptly, then sighed.
"I had forgotten. We no longer have a housekeeper."
To Bronow, he said, "I didn't realize what a spoiled creature I had become until we had to make do with 20-odd servants and slaves instead of over 100.
I think you'll like this vintage, Your Highness."
To Ali he said, "Stand by the far wall, please, Ali, out of earshot." As she obeyed, Bronow asked, "Do your people expect us to drink ourselves under the table, sending up two pitchers?" He and Mequin touched cups and tasted their wine.
"Actually, I've been drinking the local brew to help the villagers make a little extra coin against the winter," the Duke replied easily. "It's crude stuff, but if I don't drink it after I buy it, they'll return my money."
"Proud people, these Highlanders. I won't subject you to it. What do you have is a proper wine laid down by my father."
It has a southern taste, Bronow admitted, drinking.
You coddle your people, Mequon.
It would be different in Raj Muat, Mequon admitted. We are isolated here and must depend on these folk to get us through the winter.
Ali took her place and read the men's speech on their lips. She also employed her sight to catch any lies.
King Oran has turned that suspicious gaze on me now, Bronow told his friend. The old man gets stranger with each sunrise. He's hiding in his quarter of the palace, has been for weeks. All of his food is tested for poison. He had your old friend Athan Fajering executed for... Are you ready for this?
Wrong thoughts.
Mequon turned white under his summer tan.
But Athan was his chancellor for 18 years.
Bronow nodded. He was also an enemy of my dear sister-in-law, Imogene, and my charming brother, Rubinion.
You know Rubinion has never been that fond of me, Bronow continued. When Oren started to watch me, I started to think that Imogene and Rubinion might well decide to inform him that I have bad thoughts, too.
Mequon sighed, shaking his head.
I wish that you and Rubinion would reconcile. It grieves me that my two best friends are at odds, and I think you wrong your brother, suggesting that he is turning the king against you.
Rubinion is a good man, he said earnestly, almost pleading. He's reserved and hard to know, but he is a wise and strong ally.
Bronow shook his head.
You always think the best of people, Mequon. If he is so good, why didn't he come to see you off?
After a few more attempts, Mequon gave up trying to get the prince to see his brother in a kinder light.
One day, mark my words, you'll change your tune about Rubinion, he said.
The two of them are isolating that old fool, Oren,
Bronow said after his fourth cup of wine.
Soon he'll see only Imogene and Rubinion, and one day they'll come to tell the court he's dead.
They also spend plenty of time with Prince Hazarin, the prince confided. I have to hope they don't turn Oren's most likely heir against me.
Don't be ridiculous, Mequon assured him. Hazarin likes you. He always says the rest of court's much too grim when you're away.
The rest of the court is terrified of Oren, Bronow replied with a laugh. They don't dare twitch.
At last, Winamin came to say a hot bath awaited Bronow. Mequon shooed Ali out. She gathered up the wine tray and cups while he and Winamin told Bronow they would see him at supper. Once they were outside, Winamin put the tray on a side table and indicated that her husband and Ali should go upstairs. She led the way into the sitting room of what had once been Sarai and Dove's chambers. Neither girl was in sight. The Duke and Duchess took seats as Ali checked the door to the servants' stair. She could hear the maids preparing rooms for the prince and his servants. To be on the safe side, when she closed the door, she pulled the carpet up until it covered the space where the door didn't quite touch the stone floor, and stuffed the rag she used as a handkerchief in the keyhole. Then she covered the crack under the main door. She found a dust cloth and stuffed a corner of it into the keyhole. Then she opened the door to the older girl's bedchamber so that she would see if anyone came in that way. At last, she nodded to her masters.
Mequon looked at his wife.
My dear, why send Ali to wait on us? He wanted to know. I know you are busy with your domestic arrangements, but surely one of the girls with experience waiting on the nobility would have served.
He smiled kindly at Ali.
Though you did a creditable job.
Ali isn't used to Bronow as we are, my dear, Winamin explained. She might see what would be hidden to us. And she has certain useful skills.
Useful? Mequon asked, raising his brows at Ali.
I read lips, Your Grace, Ali said meekly, and I can tell you that the prince is telling the truth about why he came.
What? How could you possibly know that?
The startled Duke demanded.
Liars blink more when they lie, or they look away while they answer, Ali explained. She did not want anyone to know about her sight if she could help it. Only a fool told all of her secrets.
The prince is frightened. She looked at the Duke.
Did you see he was sweating when he talked about the situation at court?
Mequon raised his eyebrows.
All of us sweat when we think of the royal court, he said dryly. I am so accustomed to it that I didn't even notice. Truly the god blessed us when he sent you.
He held Ali's gaze with his own.
But he didn't bless you, did he?
I am your grace's servant, Ali told him, wide-eyed and earnest.
Very courtier-like,
remarked the Duke. One would think you a practiced associate of kings. Ali had to shoo him away from this line of thought. She beamed at him.
So many compliments from your grace tonight, she said, allowing her lashes to flutter. I will become conceited and the other servants will be hurt that they have not drawn your gracious attention.
Ali, the play has lost a star performer when you didn't elect to train as a professional fool, the Duchess said with a smile. Ali shrugged comically.
The player's loss is your grace's gain, she said, then added as a deliberate afterthought.
Mine too, of course. She looked at the Duke.
Truly, your grace. Why fidget over what use the god makes of insignificant me?
Because I receive better service from someone who is happy, replied Mequen. Because you are not insignificant, however much you may jest about it. And we know so little about you, except that bright Mithros said you will guide us through great trouble.
Don't blame a man for curiosity, messenger. He looked at his Duchess and sighed.
Well, my dear?
From the corner of her eye, Ali saw orange cloth in the crack between the door to the bedroom and the wall. She really would have to suggest better ways for Dove to eavesdrop.
We can accommodate them.
Barely, Winamin replied, bringing Ali's attention back to the Duke and Duchess.
We're putting his men-at-arms up in the new barn. They're not at all pleased, but they have no choice.
What of our people? Shall we send them out of the Great Hall at mealtimes?
Mequen shook his head.
Perhaps if Bronow sees how limited our space is, he'll rusticate somewhere else. Besides, our people earn their place in the hall through their work.
Realizing they had finished with her, Ali murmured a farewell, bowed, and went to the main door of the suite. Carefully, she returned the rug to its correct position and removed the dustcloth from the keyhole.
You'll remember to pour the wine at the head table at supper, won't you, Ali?
Asked the Duchess. Ali turned and bowed.
Of course, Your Grace.
First, she ought to see to her goats. When she went outside, she found the inner courtyard awash in Bronow's people, as well as anyone from Tenere who had a reasonable excuse to be present. The only quiet place was the spot near the guard barracks where Nawat worked at his bench in the sun, gluing feathers to arrow shafts. For once, he wasn't encircled by admiring females. Ali hesitated, then walked across to him. Nawat didn't even look up from the painstaking task of setting a goose feather in its bed.
Your feathers are ruffled, he said.
Well, it's very exciting having visitors and all, she said, looking at the new arrivals.
You act like a flock when a snake crawls by, the crow man pointed out.
If that is excitement, it is not the good kind.
Do you wish to mob them? To drive them away?
I couldn't, even if I wanted to, she informed him, smiling. For all his human guise, he was still very much a crow.
Impulsively, she asked, Did you get a look at him, the prince?
The one with fox-colored hair. He came to see me work.
Nawat looked up at Ali and grinned, white teeth flashing against his tanned skin.
I did it badly.
What do you make of him? Ali wanted to know. Or did you not have time to get a sense of him?
He replied with a wing shrug, then said, I do not need time. I know a hawk when I see one.
A hawk? She repeated, thinking he had recognized Bronow's hunter-bird look.
A hawk, Nawat said firmly, his eyes on his work once more. He will drive you off your own kill and steal your nestlings. He should be mobbed. Before he steals any of yours, shall you and I mob him?
Ali tugged her ear, frowning. Somehow, Nawat didn't have the same view of hawks as that held by people who'd been born human.
Unlike a hawk, Bronow comes with a flock of soldiers. You and I are outnumbered.
We could mate, Nawat suggested eagerly. In a year, our nestlings would be large enough to mob anyone we like. In 2 or 3 years, we could have still more nestlings until no hawk will venture near our territory. Shall I court you? Do you like grubs or ants better?
Ali smiled, finding him both silly and lovable.
It takes longer for human nestlings to get big enough to mob, she explained,
wondering if Aunt Dane's conversations with animals were like this. And I'm too busy to court. I've the goats to fetch for one.
I will be here, Nawat said placidly, returning to his work, in case you change your mind about mating.
Ali brought her animals in early, then spent the afternoon idling around Bronow's people. All of them were relieved to be away from the king. They spoke of the arrival of more storm wings and of the many noble families who had decided to summer in the country. Only those who feared that the king would consider their departure suspicious had remained at court. Prince Hazarin was the only noble who acted as he had always done, drinking and attending parties in the pleasure district night after night. When Bronow joined the Balitongs for supper, he brought gifts for the family. For Mequen and Winamine, he had newly published sets of books, which they received with true enthusiasm. A soldier marionette went to Elsrin, a gorgeous doll dressed in Yamani fashions to Patran, and a history of Karthak to Dove. For Sarai, Bronow produced eardrops that were clusters of tiny peach-colored moonstones, the same golden tint as her cheeks, and a gold necklace with a matching pendant. Sarai was overwhelmed. She immediately removed her white pearl eardrops and donned the new ones in their place. When she fumbled with the catch on the necklace, Bronow offered to help. Sarai lifted the heavy braided coils of her hair so that he could see better. With the necklace fastened, he turned Sarai to face him as she beamed at him.
"Lovely," Bronow said with a tender smile.
He took Sarai's hand and kissed it. Ali, standing behind them on the dais, looked at the wine tray she was holding, her mind working busily. Prince Bronow had brought gifts nicely chosen to appeal to each Balitong. It might just be coincidence that his gift to the oldest, marriageable daughter of the house was the kind of token a girl would see as an indication of special affection. It might also be coincidence that his gift had given Bronow a chance to touch Sarai, and Sarai an excuse to let him. Ali glanced at Dove. The 12-year-old held her book open to a detailed map, but her eyes were on Bronow and her sister. Mequen and Winamine had also seen the exchange between their oldest daughter and their friend. A footman collected the books, doll, and marionette as kitchen servants brought out the food. Ali poured wine into the cups of everyone on the dais, then took up the water pitcher. It was customary to dilute supper wine. She used less water for the prince, duke, duchess, and Sarai, and a good bit of it for Dove, Patran, and Elsrin, then took her position behind the prince and the duchess. The servants passed along the dais, starting with the prince and ending with Elsrin, offering a loaded tray to everyone. The older diners selected the things they wanted, while the healer Rihani chose Patran's and Elsrin's meal. The offerings were a mixture of foods of the eastern lands, southern lands, and Rakha kitchens. Ali recognized the salad of long beans, chilies, coconut, shrimp paste, and garlic, having sampled it in the leftovers from a meal back in Rajmuat. There was a noodle salad, another favorite Rakha dish adopted by the Luaran, this one with garlic, chilies, cashews, peanuts, and celery. There were chicken dumplings, dates stuffed with curried jackfruit, and pickled asparagus. Looking at it all, Ali shivered. She had eaten a great deal of rice since her arrival in the Isles, to the point where she was beginning to feel a bit grainy. It was hard to trust local fare when there was always a risk that some bright bit of red or green would set her mouth afire. But the diners here, Luaran and Rakha, ate this strange selection as easily as her own family consumed meals of apple fritters, fish pasties, and venison. The chief change to the Balitang's diet since their arrival at Tanair was the absence of seafood, which was otherwise the backbone of Isle cooking. She was grateful for the lack. There were too many volcano blast chilies in the seafood dishes of the Copper Isles. During the meal, Bronow relayed news of the capital. He described recent plays, performers, and books, and news from the eastern and southern lands. Ali took it all in, noting that Skanra continued to attack Tortal, despite heavy losses and rumors of rebellion among Magar's lords. The Luaran free servants listened to every word, as did Sergeant Veron and some of his Luaran and part Luaran men-at-arms. The Rakha and many of those who were part Rakha seemed indifferent. Bronow's people looked around at their surroundings, obviously unimpressed. "If you think we're countrified now," Ali thought evilly, "wait till they bring out the dishes made with goat's milk. That should put a pickle up your noses." Patran and Elsrin were soon squabbling, their bellies full. Their nursemaid had to gently scold them several times. Dove was intent on Bronow's conversation, but what she made of it, Ali couldn't tell. Sarai, too, was listening to the prince, her lovely eyes shining in admiration. Like Dove, Winamine and Mequen listened with polite interest but without giving away their thoughts. Ali approved. After her observation of the prince, she no more trusted him not to repeat anything the Balitongs might say than she could trust him not to repeat what other nobles had told him since the Balitongs' departure. Though their remarks were cruel, Bronow didn't seem to notice that his gossip upset his hosts. Sarai's admiring mood evaporated as she listened to what their fellow nobles had said of them. She folded her napkin into small pleats, her lips pressed tightly together. The Duke and Duchess toyed with their wine glasses, their eyes glittering. As Ali was pouring the last cup of wine for the meal, Bronow half turned to get a better look at her.
"I know you," he said with a smile. "You're the little Luaran slave who opened the door the night I brought the king's news to my friends. You've risen in the world, from doorkeeper to wine pourer."
Ali bowed. "I do all manner of chores now, Your Highness," she murmured. "I would not have had this opportunity in Rajmuat."
"I'll bet it's not as exciting here as in the capital," the prince said.
"If my memory's right, you had more of a Tortallan accent then. Did it rub off in the jungle? And your hair has grown more. The color is most becoming." He was teasing her, his gray eyes dancing. Ali knew what she was expected to do. She did it, bridling and smiling at the prince. "I've learned ever so much more since I first saw Your Highness," she told him, acting the flattered female. Privately, she supposed that Bronow was well enough, as men went, though he was much too old for her. He looked to be in his mid-thirties. Smile as he might and wink as he did when he straightened in his chair, Ali was unmoved. He did have nice hair, charm, and elegance, but he was lipless, shallow, and direct. He would bore her within a fortnight. Queen Thayet had once teased Ali that she would never find a man who could keep her attention for very long. Ali hoped that wasn't true. For now, she considered ways to avoid Bronow in case he invited her to share his bed.
"Sleep with him?"
Chenaol asked when Ali mentioned it once she had returned to the kitchen with the wine tray.
"As I told you early on, you can say no. His Grace lets his people make their own choices."
"I thought the nobility would bid their servants to please their guests," Ali remarked as she sat down to a meal of leftovers.
"Not His Grace. If they are willing, and they are protected from getting themselves with child, they may do as they please, and His Grace will defend them," Chenaol replied.
She was greasing her favorite wide cooking pot, the one like a large bowl.
"But he won't have anyone forced." The woman looked Ali full in the face. "Why do you think people are so loyal to this family?" she asked quietly. "Because all are people in this house. Raka and Luaran, slave and free. The first time Patran slapped a slave and called her a lazy cow, the Duchess spanked her and took away her dolls for a month.
Patran said she'd heard it at a friend's house, and the Duke ended the friendship.
They are good Luaran here, Ali, who knows so much."
Ali gnawed on her lower lip, then murmured, "And of course there are Duchess Saragani's heirs." She knew it was a risk to say it, but with the household aflutter with the new arrivals, the Raka might accidentally reveal more than they had before. Ali hoped to catch them off their guard.
"Why do you say heirs?" Chenaol demanded, her voice soft.
Her small brown eyes were sharp as she looked at Ali.
"Under the Luaran, only males inherit."
"Under the Luaran," Chenaol had said. Ali stuffed a rice ball into her mouth and chewed as she thought. So Chenaol knew of the old law, the law under which the females could inherit. Females such as Saragani's daughters. Ali had once heard a man-at-arms figure the population of the Isles was one white among six brown. Did that number cover the mixed bloods? Where might they stand if the Raka chose to take back their home? She was reaching for another rice ball when a sharp knife pricked the delicate skin under her ear. She was filled with admiration. She hadn't even seen Chenaol palm the blade. "Is that the boning knife or a chopping knife?" she asked politely. "If you press hard and cut down, I should bleed to death quickly. Of course, I'll make a mess."
"You're very calm for someone who's about to get her corpse dumped somewhere for the crows to eat," whispered Chenaol. "Now, this simply will not do."
A white, bright figure in the shape of a man appeared, seated across the table from Ali. Elsewhere in the kitchen, everyone froze in place, eyes and chests unmoving. Only Ali and the cook were free.
"Chenaol, my dear girl, stop that."
The bright figure spoke with Kiprioth's crisp, cheery voice, accented just now with impatience.
I send help, and how do you thank her? We won't get very far if you kill a Luaran who can be of use.
Bright one, she's a royal spy, Chenaol snapped. Too curious by half, sticking her nose in everywhere.
She is our spy, not the crown's, Kiprioth informed the cook. Imported for your purposes with not a little trouble on my part, I might add. I'll take that. The knife vanished from the cook's hand to reappear in front of the god's light shape. Ali glared at him.
I was handling this, she informed Kiprioth. I didn't need you.
Yes, but you're so careful about asking around that our wager will be done before my people realize you can help, Kiprioth said reasonably. Chenaol, why has it taken you so long to realize that Ali is someone special? Think of all the things you can do with her to help. Chenaol glanced at Ali, then at Kiprioth's glowing form. She held out her hand.
You and your games, Bright One. It would be so wonderful if you ever once gave a body a hint about what you had in mind.
I'll take my knife back, please.
She isn't very respectful, Ali pointed out, interested. She couldn't be angry with Chenaol. In her shoes, Ali would have killed such a nosy slave on the road to Tener.
Respect is hard to get when you're a trickster, the god said mournfully. People are so often inclined to think the worst of one.
Ali propped her chin on her hand. I can't imagine why, she retorted. Give the knife back.
I mean to be sure that she won't murder you when my back is turned, argued Kiprioth.
To Chenaol, he said, if you kill this spy, I'm not getting you a new one.
You should have told us, the cook repeated.
I expected you to work it out, snapped the god. I wouldn't have let a royal spy get a whiff of our girl.
Really? Must I do everything?
Without so much as a flicker, he was gone. The knife was back in Chenaol's hands. The other servants and slaves in the kitchen began moving about again, unaware that they had been held captive for a short time. Ali watched Chenaol for a moment before she said, I'm glad he's not my god. The cook gave her the thinnest of smiles.
As long as his eye's on you, girl, you are his. Mountains give way before that one does.
Ali shrugged.
All gods are like that. You can't reason with them.
Hastily she added, or so I've heard. She knew it from her mother, the goddess's own warrior, and from her aunt Dane, a demigoddess in her own right, who had met far more gods than any human would think healthy.
Chenaol sighed. And so you are a spy.
Ali winced.
Please keep your voice down.
I'll have to tell the others, Chenaol pointed out, eyeing the edge on her knife. They feared that we'd have to kill you, when all of us like you so much. Fezgao insisted we give you a chance. She put down the knife. At least the god didn't steal this. He's as bad as a crow for taking things. I got my cooking knives from my mother and she from hers.
Ali rubbed the back of her neck. Then Raka inheritance is through the mother's line, she confirmed.
Yes, of course, and the oldest child inherits. We don't care if it's a boy or a girl.
Ali looked around. No one was within hearing. Most of the staff had gone back to the main hall, where Bronow's minstrel was tuning a lute. A shimmer of bells told her some of the staff had brought out their instruments. She murmured,
So under Raka law, Sarai and Dove are their mother's heirs, and their mother was royalty, wasn't she?
Chenaol got up and poured herself a cup of arak. She sat and propped her feet on a little stool.
The last of the house, she replied, as quiet as Ali. You know, some of the Luaran nobility have taken up the custom. The first child inherits, whatever sex it may be.
But not the royal line, Ali reminded her. Chenaol lifted her cup in a silent toast.
Anything can change, she said, and drank.
Ali was drifting off to sleep when she heard steps approach her in the dark main hall. She waited, a hand on her stolen knife. Feathers rustled as two shadowy figures dropped pallets on either side of her. Ali caught the drift of jasmine scent from her left and soap mixed with aloe from her right.
You're supposed to be in your parents' room, she whispered to Dove and Sarai.
But you are more interesting and it's too hot upstairs, Sarai whispered.
Can I bear the compliment? Ali asked.
I'm not telling lioness tales all night.
It really is too hot up there, Dove said.
and we're not used to such close quarters. We can tell you stories if you like, since you're not from here.
Ali yawned as she thought quickly.
I'm too tired for a long story, she told the girls, but I'd like to know what your mother was like.
She came from the old Raqqa blood, the nobility before the Luaran conquest, replied Sarai, her voice dreamy in the shadows. She was light and color and fun. She had a laugh like small gold bells. Every day was a holiday with her. She and the present Duchess were best friends.
I suppose that made it easier for Winamine to take her place. Her voice had turned bitter. If she was trying to replace your mother, would she and your father have waited years before they wed? Ali wanted to know. I heard it was one of your aunts who made him remember he owed it to the family to remarry.
What's your mother like? Asked Sarai abruptly.
You're so cool and thinking all the time. Is that how your mother is?
Ali had wondered what she would say when this question was asked. The obvious lie that her mother was dead felt too much like an ill-wishing to her. Her mother walked dangerous roads too often for Ali even to lie about her fate. Instead, she told a different falsehood.
I never knew her, she replied. I'm told she is a traveling musician. Her company spent winters in town, and she'd live there with my father, who's a merchant. Only the year after she had me, she stopped coming. For a moment, both girls were quiet. Then Sarai whispered,
Ali, I'm sorry. We never meant to pry.
Ali put a small quiver in her voice and replied bravely,
I hardly ever think of it. Dad's so good to us.
Softly she added, She didn't leave because of my sisters, only me.
Do you mind? Someone growled nearby. We have work in the morning in case some of us have forgotten.
Ali, forgive us, whispered Dove as she lay down on her pallet. I'm your slave, Ali replied. You have the right.
Sarai murmured,
No, we don't.
The sisters fell silent.
And that should be the end of that kind of question, Ali thought, satisfied.
Essence spells. We carry our essence everywhere, in our skin, in our hair, our nails. This means that everything we touch picks up some of ourselves. The longer the contact, the more essence is transferred. Thus, if you get clothing someone has worn when he or she has been active, or hot, or upset, that clothing will supply you with more than enough essence to work a spell. Mages favor essence spells for things such as locks and keys, because such spells can be linked to the owner alone. They are foolproof. They work if the owner touches something in a hurry, while under stress, in the cold. And there are ways to go around such spells.
From a lecture on basic magical theory by Numair Salmalin at the Royal University at Corus, attended by the 13-year-old Ali.
Chapter 8. A Spy's Work.
Ali rose before dawn, as usual, since the Duchess had not suggested that she give up her daytime work. She emerged from the kitchen wing to find Nawat seated on the rim of the well that served the cooks. He was surrounded by crows. The birds had found seats on the well's cover, Nawat's shoulders, the ground, the kitchen garden fence, and even the archery targets set up between the barracks and the garden. All of the birds looked as pleased as any human to be up so early, with the sun just showing above the eastern horizon. They sat or stood or walked, feathers ruffled against the early morning chill, eyes half shut with sleep. They stirred as Ali moved through them. Nawat turned to look at her.
My clan has come, he explained. We will mob the Bronau Hawk if you ask it. He is a danger to humans and their nestlings.
Ali scratched her head. What was she supposed to say to that? Certainly she agreed. Her wager depended on keeping the Balitang nestlings alive this summer. Bronau was one of the factors that put them at risk. It's not so easy among two-leggers, she explained, wondering how she could explain human politics to her feathered allies. We can't drive him off. We'll put the nestlings in more danger if we do. One crow made a croaking noise that sounded like a variation on the call to attack and kill.
Then let us kill him and his flock, Nawat said brightly. He cannot kill or steal anyone if his bones are scattered between here and the mountains.
Ali sighed.
Nawat, it's not just Bronau. These soldiers who follow him,
They are not his entire flock. He has a vast flock that will come to destroy everything where he was killed. Understand? His brother, his sister-in-law, the king.
Nawat regarded her with puzzlement, head cocked to one side. The other crows have the same expression and tilt to their heads.
Humans do these things differently.
Ali knew she sounded feeble, but she was unsure how to explain